He is a very well-known researcher in meteorological and atmospheric science circles, works a lot these days on cloud physics and what clouds and due to climate change with respect to various atmospheric phenomena. But he also has long-standing interests that he's developed over the last several years in climate change coming from a much more human perspective, I suppose. And today, he's going to address that. His title is a fascinating one. Now, keep in mind that he is an atmospheric physicist. But his title, as you can see, is it possible to decouple economic wealth from carbon dioxide emission rights? Tim, over to you.
Thank you very much, Tom. So my title is, is it possible to decouple economic wealth from carbon dioxide emission rates? And this is led to a paper that appeared in Climatic Change. It's still just online, it's not in print, but it's online at the Climatic Change website, entitled, Are There Basic Physical Constraints on Future Anthropogenic Emissions of Carbon Dioxide? And in the article, conclusions are perhaps some that are a little bit, provocative, but among them are that, perhaps contrary to popular belief, improving energy efficiency actually leads to accelerated carbon dioxide emissions growth rather than reduced carbon dioxide emissions growth. And also, absent collapsing the economy, in other words, turning the inflation-adjusted GDP to zero, emissions can only be stabilized by building the equivalent of about one nuclear power plant per day globally. And perhaps because both of those things seem somewhat improbable, civilization has inertia, and its present state and its present growth rate are determined by the past, and the past fundamentally cannot be changed. So we are set on a trajectory that perhaps can lead to simplified predictions of the future. But really, I mean, how this started off was just a simple question of, I think maybe a question many of us have asked, which is, where does the value of money come from? All of us, perhaps I shouldn't be asking that, I have no background in economic sciences, but we all have perhaps more field experience in the economic world than we have in any other profession that we might have. I may be a cloud physicist, but I certainly have more field experience in the economic world just buying stuff on a daily basis. And I think it's just an intuitive question. We have this thing called money, and, it's just a piece of paper, and it seems to be able to do stuff. I mean, with money, you can do almost anything if you have enough of it. And there's no restriction. There isn't a different type of money for different types of things. And, where does this value come from? Economists would say that it's fundamentally, I think, belief-based, that I believe it has value, you believe it has value, and therefore it has value. But I think coming from a physics background, that may be true, probably almost certainly is true, but it's a bit unsatisfactory of an explanation because it doesn't really explain where the belief comes from. Why is that belief so resilient? Presumably the belief has some representation that can be explained physically, since civilization certainly is part of the physical universe. It's not separate from it. We are all part of the physical world. So I had this hunch, I could call it a hypothesis, but that really sounds a bit more formal since this was really just an armchair philosophical question. But the hunch was that maybe civilization can be considered to be just an organism, like any other organism. And as an organism, it can be defined physically, where physics is about the transformation of energy from one state to another. There are basic laws of thermodynamics. And fundamentally, physics is about the transfer of energy, or really the flow of energy downhill, or more strictly, the flow of material downhill from a high potential state to a low potential state. So you can just think of a ball rolling from a high gravitational potential to a low gravitational potential. And you could think, well, stuff happens in civilization, so that's perhaps what we value, is the stuff happening. So perhaps maybe that money is simply a representation of some energetic flow from high potential to low potential. Just a very simple, intuitive argument that perhaps economic wealth that money is a representation of a rate of consumption of energy. I think it's an intuitive idea. And, you know, perhaps I could take something from the recent news, which was this Wood Buffalo National Park that was coming from? I think, you know, a beaver dam is perhaps, you know, a nice analogy for, we talk about beaverdom and beaverdom having its own version of civilization. But in this case, what I was trying to develop was actually a thermodynamic explanation. I won't go into the details of the thermodynamics here in the article that's published online. But you can think of a beaver dam, well, it has its own sort of representation of civilization. And what's the size of beaver civilization? Well, you can think of civilization in the case of a beaver being represented by some potential difference right here between a high gravitational potential and a low gravitational potential. And there's an energy reservoir behind it. But really, for the beavers, you could measure the size of the civilization for the beavers by a flow of water across this potential difference, where the total flow of water is this potential difference right here times the length of the beaver dam, which in this case was 835 meters apparently, so longest in the world. So perhaps we could think of something similar. I mean, this is rather abstract, but we could perhaps think of something similar applying to human civilization. You know, of course, if human civilization might be more difficult to conceive as being a line, but the thought was that civilization perhaps represents a gradient between available energy supplies, which in our case would represent things like coal, oil, and uranium, and a point of low potential, which in our case would probably be outer space. Well, probably with the beavers too, ultimately. Because we consume energy, things happen in civilization due to the flow across that potential gradient. And ultimately, there's waste heat that's released, and that gets radiated to outer space at a cold temperature of about 255 Kelvin. So, coming back to this hunch. So this is, the hunch is that there's a, physics is about energy transformation, so maybe we can treat civilization as a physical entity, as a single organism that interacts on a global scale with available energy reservoirs. And through the transformation of that energy reservoir, that energy, it does stuff. And money, the value of money, is a representation of that capacity to do stuff physically. So, I mean, we can test this. This is a testable hypothesis. And it can be expressed mathematically, which means that we can look at this quantifiably. But the idea here is just simply that we have a rate of energy consumption. I gave it the symbol A because it's available energy. So there's a rate of energy consumption. So this would have units of perhaps watts, if you wanted to think of it this way, on a global scale. And then we have something called wealth. And wealth would have units of currency. And here it's adjusted for inflation. And then the hypothesis is just that these two quantities are related through a constant that does not change over time. That's a testable hypothesis. Now, the problem here is what is wealth? And I think, you know, you can think of this with the beavers or with us. Wealth is obviously something that I think has accumulated over time. The beavers started off as something small, and then based on what we currently have, we are able to grow what we currently have to produce more that adds to what we currently have, which then gives us more power to produce more in the future. And it's through this positive feedback that civilization or a beaver dam is able to grow. And then, so the question then is, well, how would you calculate wealth? And, I mean, I was entirely naive in this. I think economists, I don't know what economists do, but they do something a bit different here. But the idea was simply to take, well, I don't know, let's see, what's wealth? I don't know, as a guess, there's statistics for global GDP. In fact, there's some statistics going rather far back in time I can use. And take these statistics for global GDP, adjust them for inflation, seems like a sensible thing to do, and just add up all the economic production from the beginning of history, civilization, up to the present, and that will give us our wealth. So GDP has units of currency per time, so it's a production per year. And you think, well, production is producing real production, inflation-adjusted production is producing something new that adds to what we currently have, and that added over time creates our wealth. And hypothesis is that's related to our rate of energy consumption, through a constant value. So we've got statistics that can be used to test this hypothesis. There are GDP statistics available from the United Nations since 1970 that are adjusted for inflation to 1990 equivalent US dollars. And then there's some historical world GDP estimates since 1 AD. Now, they're quite far back. They're quite sparse going back in time. The first one's 1 AD, and then 1,000 AD, then 1,500. And they're probably quite uncertain. So when doing the integral, that you could think that's going to provide some source of uncertainty in the total calculation of wealth. However, fortunately, the GDP today is so immensely larger than it was way back in history that the uncertainty is actually is relatively insensitive, the total calculation, to the calculations way back in time. And I did some tests on what that might be. And then the global primary energy production statistics since 1970. So this is the total consumption of energy by civilization as a whole in terms of uranium, oil, coal, whatever. And then we have CO2 emission statistics from CDISE, where the ultimately I'm going to try to compare this to carbon dioxide emissions. So I will show a graph for this, but first I'll start off with a table. But the nice thing was that this hypothesis actually turns out to be supported by the data to an extremely high degree of confidence. The uncertainty, the value turns out to be 9.7 milliwatts per 1990 US dollar. So every US dollar has what turns that piece of paper into something that has a potential to do something is 9.7 milliwatts of continuous energy consumption. And just to show some numbers that I just chose, they're decades, and I chose the most recent for which I have statistics. Here are the global energy consumption rates in terawatts, starting at 7.2 in 1970, going up to close to 16 terawatts in 2007. And here's the economic wealth. That's that time integral I showed. And that's gone up from $821 trillion in 1990 dollars to $1,620 in 2007. And the ratio of these two quantities has remained roughly constant over time. And so this is the uncertainty in the mean. So it's not the standard deviation. It's just the uncertainty in the mean, adjusted for things like autocorrelation of the time series. So you can see here that, there's some variation. Perhaps that's due to uncertainties in the estimates, calculations, but it's relatively constant. Here's the statistic shown in graphical form. So what I show here is, don't go all the way back to 1 AD, but from 1700 on to 2000, here are statistics for GDP. She uses the symbol P here. Inflation-adjusted world GDP. It's a green line. And you can see there have been bursts around 1880 and 1950. And today, the GDP is about 100 times larger than it was in 1970. Now, the time integral of GDP, the total wealth, we could call it that, is, of course, mathematically, it has to be a smoother, more slowly varying function because it's determined as much by the past as the present. And that is increased by about a factor of 6 or 7 from 1700, I think it's about, $300 trillion or something? About $300 trillion in 1700, and today it's about $1,700 trillion, 1990 dollars. And then we have the statistics for energy consumption, which is this red line. And what I've done is blow this up here, and this is wealth in dollars, and this is energy consumption, and you can see that they're pretty much growing in tandem. So that the relationship, you divide one by the other and you get more or less a constant line. And in fact, this line is actually becoming more and more stable as we go on in time, perhaps because the statistics are just better. Economists don't seem to provide uncertainty limits on their calculations, estimates of GDP. In fact, GDP, global GDP, goes out to, I think, 10 significant digits or 9 significant digits. What you get from the UN, which is a bit odd, with no uncertainty limits. So, I don't know what the uncertainty is here in their calculations, but nonetheless, it seems to be converging on something fairly stable. So that's encouraging. It suggests the hypothesis is correct, that fundamentally, money is power. So, Now, to move on to CO2 emissions, I think that makes for a very simple calculation for how emissions is related to wealth. So what we have here, this is the value of civilization, which today is about $1,700 trillion, $1,990. This is that constant I mentioned, which is 9.7 milliwatts per $1,990. Doesn't seem to be changing with time. And this is the carbonization of the energy supply. So we have, people say we have a fossil fuel economy fundamentally. So this is just a representation of the relationship between energy consumption and carbon dioxide emissions through just this simple equation right here. Energy consumption times carbonization gives you the carbon dioxide emissions rates. And you can see from this equation that emissions rates are really just fundamentally linked to the wealth of civilization. Barring a change in carbonization, and carbonization hasn't been changing at all recently. I mean, it's just, I think the time scale for carbonization change is about 300 years right now. So these two things are fundamentally linked. You cannot reduce emissions rates without reducing the wealth of civilization. It's just a fundamental relationship. Because wealth is energy consumption is carbon dioxide emissions, the two are inseparable. Which means that we cannot decouple wealth from carbon dioxide emissions without turning away from a fossil fuel economy. There are simply no other options, period. And as it turns out, if you want to at least stabilize carbon dioxide emissions, you would have to decarbonize as fast as the current growth rate in energy consumption, which works out to about one nuclear power plant per day. So that's what would have to be built globally. I mean, it doesn't have to be nuclear power, but it has to be some non-CO2 emitting power supply. So to compare, I mean, this isn't the approach that's normally portrayed in, say, the IPCC framework. In the IPCC framework, they have a rather more complex approach. They have very sophisticated and complex societal models that are based on trends in things like population, prosperity, which is the GDP per population, energy efficiency, which is the energy required to produce a dollar of GDP, and decarbonization. And in the model I discuss, it's just wealth and carbonization. All these things are implicitly folded in to wealth. So it's not that they aren't part of the whole thing, but they are implicit, and one really only has to know these two things. And as I was later discuss, really this one is just a function of energy efficiency. And I'll get into this later. So it's basically a much simpler way of looking at the human system, treating it as an entire organism, where the monetary wealth is related to something that's physical, which is energy consumption. So I think it brings up the question of what is the future? If we have a more simple way of portraying things, can we make forecasts in the future that are perhaps more constrained? Now, I should say here that there are very fundamental thermodynamic arguments, I think, why you cannot predict the future. You can only know what you know based on what we have seen from the past. And based on what we have seen from the past, we can make an estimate of what the future is going to be. But there are things that are fundamentally unknowable to us that could have an impact on the future. I mean, perhaps there's some, asteroid that impacts the Earth that we just don't catch and comes in. I mean, we just can't predict those sorts of things. There are aspects of the future that we cannot predict. But, I think you can perhaps say that this might be at least a more constrained question of how will wealth grow? And in that regard, I think, we could do something that's perhaps a little simple. I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of physical basis for this. There might be. It's kind of a fun graph, though. Well, all I did is actually got me a little bit interested in the problem. I still can't really quite explain this plot. But if you look at atmospheric CO2 concentration in parts per million by volume and compare that with the world GDP on the log-log plot, these are statistics for CO2 concentration from various sources, including ice cores, going back to 2 AD. And you plot that against the world GDP, and it's pretty much a straight line on the log-log plot. The perturbation of carbon dioxide concentrations seems to go as a square root of GDP. I don't know why. But maybe this is just coincidence. And I, you know, fundamentally I'm trying to compare things to wealth anyway, which is the time integral of GDP. And maybe there is some underlying thing that's governing both of these properties. But at the very least, it suggests that, well, you know, if we want to reduce CO2, you know, something has to collapse. And in fact, even more amusing way of looking at this is that, is to switch around the graph and look at it in more recent years. Here's GDP plotted against atmospheric CO2. And there's, you know, very, very tight relationship between the two. And it's $407 billion per year per part per million CO2, which suggests that you could just go to the top of Mauna Loa with a CO2 monitor and measure the size of the global economy to a high degree of accuracy. And anyway, it's just fun. But, I mean, more seriously, I mean, this is really what the model is. It's a dynamic model that can be, whenever you have a time integral, you can express it as a differential equation, some couple differential equations. And that, rather than show you the differential equations, I'm just expressing this in a sort of a pictorial framework. So really what we have here is we have wealth. Wealth produces GDP, inflation adjusted, which then adds to wealth. So this was that integral part I was showing to you. But you know, what's implicit in that is that GDP adds to wealth. So this is a bit like to with a particular rate of return. And as I show in the paper, that this is fundamentally related to the energy efficiency of the system. I'll discuss that in a second. But let's say you put money in the bank. You can expect a rate of return above inflation, perhaps. So that's a rate of return above inflation that produces your real production. And that adds to your wealth, which then, you know, this is just compound interest. That's all this is expressing right here. The main result here is that this cycle of compound interest is fundamentally linked to physics through this parameter lambda that I discussed earlier, this 9.7 milliwatts per inflation adjusted dollar. So that wealth is a representation of energy consumption rates. GDP, real GDP, is a representation of the growth in energy consumption rates. So GDP is just an abstract representation of our capacity to increase our ability to increase our capacity to consume more energy in the future. That's what the production really represents. And so there's the same rate of return here as there is here. These are just identical loops related only through a constant. So just multiply this by this. And of course, the nice thing about this is that, well, energy consumption is related to CO2 emissions through a very simple relationship. It's combustion leads to CO2. So this is a, you know, just, we can relate the two very easily now, between wealth and CO2 emissions. And, you know, to perhaps explain this, I think we can, this is very intuitive, because here's a picture of my son as a three-year-old, and here he's eating apples off the tree, and, you know, he eats, takes the potential energy and carbohydrates and incorporates the nutrients, the material is in the nutrients, into his body, which enables him to consume more in the future. And as he's eating one apple, he's reaching out for the other. There's a positive feedback loop there that leads to him eating far more today as a six-year-old than he did as a three-year-old. And you know, this is throughout nature. This is talk about a tree doing the same thing. It takes a through photosynthesis, it takes the potential energy in available sunlight to incorporate nutrients from the soil and from the air in order to grow. And as it grows, it is able to do that more in the future. And with either of these cases, things like, you could think of this being done with a certain degree of efficiency. And the efficiency in this case could be positive or negative. If this thing is done efficiently, then the system will grow faster. It will be able to incorporate the nutrients efficiently and then grow and then consume more in the future. If it's perhaps diseased, then the plant here might die, and then the efficiency would be negative. And then you would have, rather than exponential increase, an exponential decay. Because even though it is incorporating nutrients, it cannot offset some environmental predation due to, let's say, a disease. So we have an efficiency there, and if the efficiency is positive or is higher, the system will grow faster. Works too for a snowflake. If this is my own area or a droplet, I can write down the equations for this. In the case of a snowflake or a droplet, the snowflake or droplet grows due to a potential gradient in supersaturation, the potential energy associated with higher vapor concentration far from the snowflake or droplet compared to the surface. And that drives a gradient of water vapor to the snowflake that enables it to grow, that increases its boundaries with its surroundings, that then enables it to grow even faster. And here the efficiency of the system is fundamentally determined by things like the diffusivity of water vapor and air. And anyway, we could apply this to civilization, and this is actually a phenomenon that's been addressed before, which is that if we increase energy efficiency, it leads to accelerated growth and more energy consumption. I mean, I think we are quite familiar with the system. We get an energy efficient fridge, and well, you know, we can have two energy efficiency fridges now and use one to store the beer in the basement. And, you know, so it's cheaper to run now. And, you know, we end up consuming more energy rather than less. And this is actually something known as Jevons' paradox that was first raised in 1865. And Jevons, I mean, he's kind of a neat guy. He took life way too seriously, and I think died at a young age because he was just, I don't know, he thought too hard. And I don't know what he did. But anyway, he was perhaps the first energy economist, and he raised the alarm in Britain at the time that there was a finite supply of coal and that perhaps Britain could expect to run out of coal in around 1960, which was actually a pretty good forecast. And he said this: it's wholly a confusion of ideas to suppose that the economical use of fuel is equivalent to a diminished consumption. The very contrary is the truth. Every improvement of the steam engine, which in that case was what was relevant when affected, does but accelerate anew the consumption of coal. So coming back to this, you know, it's just if we increase energy efficiency, this increases this feedback loop, and we actually get something called super exponential growth in that case, and that leads to ever accelerated increase of carbon dioxide emissions. So to come back to this plot right here, one can actually calculate this based on observations, this rate of this feedback loop, this rate of return in the system. And the rate of return in the system is here, this purple line. And the rate of return here is the ratio of the GDP to the wealth. So what you get back from the bank and relative to what's in the bank. And as you can see, this purple line has increased from about 0.1% per year in 1700 to 2.2% per year. So the current rate of return of civilization. That's a real rate of return of civilization. Based on our wealth, we get 2.2% per year back as added wealth. Higher than it's ever been before in history. And there's neat to think here as you look that there's inflection points in this, one around 1880 and one around 1950. And it's fun to think about what might be physical reasons for why there are these inflection points. And I imagine that they're perhaps associated with discovery of new energy reservoirs. So that fundamentally this problem is a geological problem rather than a societal one. So perhaps this is Saudi Arabia, and I don't know, think of, you know, discovery of, this is when oil was first started being used in civilization. So maybe this is just inflection points associated with discovery of oil. Anyway, there is this rate of return. And a key point here is that the rate of return is stopping increasing now. It seems to be stagnating in recent years. And it's stagnating really for the first time since about the 1930s. And so I wonder if this is related to the current economic crisis, that really it's a representation of the rate of return has stopped increasing. Between 1950 and 1970, it was just going gangbusters. It was increasing faster than it had ever had before. It had a doubling time of just 20 years. But since then, things have sort of slowed down a bit. Anyway, what that means is that we can make predictions for the future, and this is really my final point, that if this rate, this feedback loop is actually stagnating, then we can actually perhaps make a forecast and assume that this rate of return is just going to hold for the foreseeable future. And here what I've plotted here is I put this into a simple model that you can just run in MATLAB. I assume some sink for atmospheric CO2 in the atmosphere. That's based, it's 1.7% per year for the atmospheric perturbation for sink into the oceans. That seems to work very well, actually. It's very simple. It's just a very simple linear couple model. and make forecasts into the future for various scenarios. So the forecasts here, this is observations up to the present, and then I just run the model for CO2 versus gross world product. And this goes out to 2050, and that's this part right here, and this is 2100, so it's sort of a phase plot, really, out here. Now, the business as usual, I guess you could call it, scenario, which is that the growth rates, that rate of return, isn't changing with time. And we have no decarbonization. We aren't really decarbonizing. Perhaps we're trying, but we aren't really. And so we just assume business as usual. And that puts us up at about 2100, well, much higher GDP, about 10 times higher, and an atmospheric CO2 of, well, about, I don't know, 1,200 parts per million by volume, which would mean a very high rate, very high increase in surface temperature. So something perhaps unbearable. And I think, you know, you look at this, well, that's meaning that GDP is growing at 2.2% per year. And, you know, that's perhaps acceptable, but... Yeah, I mean, I think you look at this and you think, well, you know, something's obviously wrong here. We can't have a gross world product of $300 trillion per year when we're at $40 trillion per year right now and have a temperature rise of something like this. Something's got to give. And, you know, you can think, well, you know, what's going to give in this case? Now, something's missing from the model. And I don't know how to do this yet, but... You can imagine, well, maybe the wealth growth rates, maybe the CO2 is fundamentally like a disease on the system. And if it's like a disease on the system, then perhaps the wealth growth rates will fall. So let's say they have in just 50 years. So in 50 years, the wealth growth rate or the GDP growth is not 2.2% per year, but rather it's 1.1% per year. Well, that would put us still at something that's a rather high atmospheric CO2 concentration by 2100, and even by 2050, a rather high CO2 concentration. And it also implies that we would sometime before 2050 enter a point where GDP is decreasing, which I would, you could imagine this like a permanent depression in the economic system. Or you could decarbonize. Well, maybe decarbonization might work. I think I messed up these lines. This should be 50 years right here, this thin line right here. So let's say we switch to non-CO2 power supplies. We have our carbonization in just 50 years, which is, you know, ridiculously rapid. Well, that would still put us at a very high CO2 concentration at this point, with perhaps very high temperature rises. So, you know, with the high GDP, or maybe it's some combination of the two, which we have wealth growth and carbonization in 50 years, do both at the same time, and that puts us on a curve like this, which would keep us under 500 parts per million by volume, but it would be associated, of course, with a depression. It doesn't look like there's any particularly good ways out, because these are really the only options that are available, at least the free parameters in this model. So I think, you know, in conclusion, I mean, is it possible to decouple economic wealth from carbon dioxide emission rates? I think the answer is no. It's just simply, it's not, unless there is very rapid decarbonization. But then you have to ask the question, well, you know, wouldn't that be extremely expensive? So, I mean, if it's expensive, then no. I mean, I think that's stuck. And I think, you know, if basically, this is just an interesting physics problem, even if it is, does have practical implications. And what I'd like to continue thinking about is, you know, how would you model this perhaps a bit in a bit more sophisticated way? And I think fundamentally, you think the growth of civilization, if it's an organism, it's dependent, it's a function of the availability of the energy supply or the size of geological reservoirs. And you know, whether we grow into these new reservoirs or we don't, or we're going to deplete these reservoirs. And there may be environmental forces, too, that inhibit our capacity to grow into these reservoirs, perhaps due to increased carbon dioxide concentrations. And I think in that context, it's interesting to think about whether civilization's growth is fundamentally what we would call a deterministic problem. Maybe we can't predict the future based on what we know, but it is fundamentally something that can be modeled as any other physical problem using differential equations subject to initial conditions. And so I'll leave it at that. And thank you.
Well, I'm sure Professor Garrett would take questions for what's been a remarkably stimulating discussion.
Hominids' discovery and domestication of fire has led to a straight line train of thinking that has got you to carbon as the only option. We could take different courses, and we still can.
Your assumption is that we will continue to demand and use carbon at something like much greater than the rates of the past, but it'll be the sort of bedrock of civilization. Humans or early hominids lived quite reasonably well before we domesticated fire. I'm sure we could go back and find, with a little lateral thinking, new ways to live that won't be absolutely abhorrent to us.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not excluding any of that, any of those possibilities.
Carbon should not be a sort of bedrock of your thinking there.
In these options in the future, decarbonizing is a free parameter. Yeah, I mean, I suspect that it perhaps isn't actually a free parameter, and that ultimately, if you could do things properly, there you could model this still as a deterministic system where there is competition between various power supply support sources depending on the relative availability of energy for each power supply source, and that ultimately it's still a deterministic problem where what energy supplies we actually use is a function of what is most readily available. But yeah, you're right. I mean, there's nothing I can't exclude, you know, very rapid decarbonization.
We are being webcast, so if you could use the microphone to ask some questions.
Tim, in your presentation, one of the slides had a formula where you had introduced a parameter called small c for
yeah.
Decarbonization.
Yes.
And you seem to suggest that it hadn't changed, this value hadn't changed in 300 years or so.
No, sorry, that was the... I wish I could say that, because I wish there were statistics to show that. There aren't. The statistics are only since 1970, unfortunately.
Yeah, but so my question is really, are you basically suggesting that the influence or the impact of, say, nuclear energy is actually negligible in the whole...
No, so the carbonization, well, was it 80, I think something like 86% of the energy supply right now is from fossil fuel-related sources, something like that. So there is a remainder, of course, that's from things like nuclear energy and other stuff. My point is simply that based on the observations from the past 40 years or so, the carbonization has not changed, so that we are... that. Fraction, let's say it's 86%, has maintained relatively constant over time. I mean, there's some wiggles up and down, but there is no clear long-term trend in that relationship, in the carbonization of civilization. That doesn't mean that it won't suddenly change in the future, but
so
there's no indication that it will.
So it's only valid since the 70s or so?
The 70s. That's all the statistics are. I mean, I can't find any statistics going further back. Maybe there are people who have worked it out, but I can't find it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a really fascinating and fun presentation. You're probably familiar with the limits to growth controversy in the early 70s, in which there was a...
The which growth?
Limits to growth. The work out of MIT with Danella and Dennis Meadows working with the Jay Forrester early simulation models to simulate exactly these kinds of dynamic models of economies. And there was a massive controversy because it was the first publication out of the Club of Rome, and it got a lot of press because essentially it was saying we're going to run out of natural resources in a very short period, historically. The controversy revolved around the question whether or not there isn't exactly the kind of substitution possibilities you're just referring to. I mean, you got a really interesting empirical situation where this constant lambda is looks pretty fixed, looks pretty static, and the C looks static. But I think you said that, in fact, both of those things are up for grabs. They could be changed with behavioral change that you argue is implausible. But that's where the issue presumably would arise, is whether or not those kinds of adjustments aren't within the realm of possibility. So we don't have a physical law that says we can't decouple. We have an economic regularity that you've observed. Your hypothesis is lambda is a constant, and you've tested that. It looks to be borne out at the moment. But if I understand you correctly, you are not making an observation, a claim that there's a physical law which requires that this rebound effect always work to maintain that constant. And just one other footnote, then I quit. If instead of talking about wealth as the integral of gross domestic product, you talked about it as the integral of net domestic product, then you'd be very close to the standard definition in the economics literature dealing with growth models and long-term dynamic models.
So with the first point, I actually am making the claim that lambda is a constant and that fundamentally money is a representation of a rate of energy consumption. They are two different things that are related by observationally by some coefficient. They are fundamentally the same thing. I had started off with a hypothesis based on just physical intuition that these are representations of the same thing. And then I looked to observations to see whether that hypothesis was supported. Now, perhaps hypothesis, yes, is based on data since 1970. Perhaps hypothesis doesn't only holds for that observable time period. Nonetheless, wealth has more than doubled in that time period. GDP has more than tripled. So it's covering a good fraction of the total growth of civilization. I see no evidence in the data that lambda is mutable. And in the physical intuition, they are exactly the same thing. So that would mean that the Jevons paradox is a fundamental property of the economic system in this treatment. That the system only grows because of what is effectively a net increase in energy efficiency of the system. That is what's driving civilization growth. Now, with regards to standard economic models, I go into a detailed discussion of this in the article. It's a bit sophisticated. I'm not sure I can bring it up on top of my head. But there is a difference, yes, between net production and the gross domestic production. And I think that gross domestic production is actually the appropriate one to use. And that rather where the difference is perhaps in consumption that goes on and or depreciation that would be in a standard economic model. And in my model, those terms are represent the difference between real production and nominal production. So that inflation is intrinsically a representation of the decay of the system. So, I mean, you're shaking your head, but I realize that this is separate from the standard economist's way of looking at it. But that's the way the equations work out, and it is supported by observations in this case.
Thanks very much. Thank you. I really appreciated your going out on a limb interdisciplinarily. I think what this shows us is that some of the assumptions from each discipline looked at through the assumptions of physics, which is, of course, causally deterministic, sort of lend us arguments that support other assumptions in other disciplines. So I think it's a brilliant move to kind of make that tricky step into talking to economics where, you know, people will siloed way say, well, you can't do that. I really applaud that. And what I thought was the decoupling thing in your civilizational model, could we think of if an organism dies, if in the organismic model of the civilization, could we think of decoupling unless that civilization dies, decoupling material interests from money, such that an organism is related to survivability and material interests and a kind of basic living thing. So could the model think through decoupling that kind of materiality?
Well, fundamentally, nothing happens without, I mean, the way I think about it is that nothing happens in the universe without there being a material flow from high potential to low potential. I mean, that's just second law of thermodynamics. That's just, you know, if you've got a hat, you know, something you can hang your hat on, that's it. I mean, that's about as fundamental as law as there gets. All other physics must bow down before that basic principle. And my concept is just civilization is inseparable from the rest of the universe. So I cannot imagine a situation as a physicist where that situation does not apply. And if there is a material flow, then we can represent that monetarily. In that light, though, however, I mean, I'm just sort of guessing right here. But you can imagine a subsistence economy, perhaps, one that does not actually grow. Now, a subsistence economy is actually going to consume energy, nonetheless. But it will only consume energy enough energy that is sufficient to offset natural decay. So that it's the same size. I mean, it still has to do stuff, but it has to do that in order to offset the natural decay so that it's the same size the next year as it is in the current year. Even there is material flow. But I think in a subsistence economy, and this is what I've observed in my own experience, I once lived in a place that had parts of the place economy were subsistence, and there the statement was food is free. And I thought that was interesting because it may be that there's no need for money if you're just going from the same place from one year to the next. And that money actually gets introduced when you are in a growing system and it represents some capacity of that system to actually increase in its size by the following year. But, you know, I'm just guessing.
Kim, I also applaud your application of basic conservation principles to economics, where they like to assume infinite resources, which isn't always the case. And I was wondering if these same ideas could be applied to previous civilizations that were not necessarily fuel-based, but maybe water-based, and how they developed and eventually came as they started using up their resources, what happened to them, whether you could use that data as a further test of these ideas.
So you could provide an example? I'm trying to think of a water-based civilization.
Oh, well, there's a number of examples, mostly in North America, of societies like the Pueblo Indians and the Mound Indians of Indiana. There's suspicions that the Mayan civilization collapsed because of water resource problems. Of course, the problem is there's probably not enough data to do anything useful. But
yeah, I mean it starts sounding like a hard problem, and you know, I still have to get grants for cloud physics. And, but I mean, still, you know, water is a material. I mean, like water isn't energy. Nobody's burning water, and the water is perhaps like with the Beaver Dam, or we have dams too. It is the material that enables the flow to happen from a high potential to a low potential. We incorporate material into our bodies. It's all sorts of minerals. And the fact is that the things, you have the potential energy difference, but the potential energy difference is meaningless without the material resources to be coupled with that, because there has to be a flow. So we have things like mines. Mines are, you can't just have the energy, you can't just have the oil. You also have to have the mines to provide us with the mineral resources to incorporate into the system so that there is a material flow that enables us to grow. And it may be that we can't access energy in the future as much because, well, the energy resources may disappear, but we may also run out of the material resources that enable us to build the machines that enable us to grow into new energy resources.
That's actually why I thought of water, because it is a finite resource.
Yeah.
And
two more questions on 1.0 and
the monitor. So I think that I think there are a couple of different discussions going. I also want to say thanks for an incredibly provocative approach and ideas and metaphors. I think it lends all kinds of sort of concept challenging ideas to a lot of work. So thanks for that. In terms of your actual model, a very simple and maybe an ignorant question. So you looked at a fossil fuel-based economy and carbon emission world of the last 40 years.
Yes. I'm not just looking at the fossil. When I look at total energy consumption, I'm looking at from all portions of the economy and all types of energy. It's not just fossil fuels.
So you mentioned something like 87% or so being
yes.
fossil fuel-based. So
yep.
if you were to pull out, maybe this goes back to the question raised earlier, if you were to pull out, for example, of course I'm looking for a way out, right?
Yeah, sure.
So I think like we all are,
yeah, sure.
Because that would be the nice thing. Eco-efficiency was a great promise. You're saying it's a figment of the imagination and
yeah.
it only makes things worse.
Yeah.
So nuclear power, can we get that extra energy in some other way, or do we simply need to acknowledge that we are a people, a global people, living in an incredibly fortunate time, and that's probably it for the rest of... So you see sort of the dilemma. How do we make sense of this and move forward, or just simply enjoy?
So, yeah, I just simply enjoy. That's how I approach this. You drink and be merry. yeah, maybe there's a way out. But, yeah, it's hard to... The only option I can see is extremely rapid decarbonization. But it would have to be extraordinarily rapid. I mean, essentially what we're talking about, perhaps, is attempting to decouple ourselves from our natural environment. And there I sort of think, well, how do you decouple yourselves from the natural environment? Perhaps the way to do it is to use only energy supplies that the natural environment can't access. And there you have perhaps something, you know, you're talking about something like nuclear power, where it's just simply, you know, that's just not available. It's not an available energy supply for the rest of the natural world. But even then, if civilization continues growing, I mean, I think as Eric was pointing out, that you, in order to keep consuming that energy, we still have to consume things like mineral resources. And those mineral resources, I think that's inescapable, that those still have to come from the natural world. So, I mean, ultimately, I mean, it's the common adage. I mean, things can't just keep growing to infinity. So at some point, things have to collapse. Collapse is an intrinsic part of every single system. I mean, right up to stars, they collapse. So at some point, civilization has to collapse, I think. It's just a point, you know, where are we on that trajectory?
Hi. Jamie Lawson from Political Science, and I'm interested because I go on forays beyond my own discipline a lot, and I know how one can stumble upon things in another discipline, and that's always frightening because you realize there's been a conversation over there that you don't go into until much later yourself. So I'm interested in the parallels that I'm hearing in political economy with Georgescu Roggins, Elmer Altvater, people like that, and you haven't chosen to focus on where you're getting your heterodox economics, but I think that would be interesting for me to hear a bit about who's influenced you and how do you see your own steps away from economics material. We hear about Jevons, you know, certainly. But.
I mean, well, Jevons is a bit of an inspiration, but I mean, really, I mean, seriously, all I know about economics I picked up on Wikipedia. I mean, it's, and, you know, nice thing about Wikipedia is that it connects you through all these things, and then you come across names like this person, Georgescu Roggins, is that his name, who was looking at the role of entropy production in the economic system. And, yeah, there's, I mean, the concept that fundamentally civilization has to be something that can be expressed physically is, I mean, it's, yeah, and lots of people have come up with that idea. The difference between what I've done and what other people have done is, I think it's perhaps twofold. One is people generally looked at things on a national scale, where I think the most sensible thing to do is to look at things as a global scale, to treat the entirety as a single organism, because then you don't have to worry about complications like trade. And also, that's the only thing that matters for carbon dioxide emissions, because CO2 is a well-mixed gas. And the other thing is that in past work, what's generally been done is to compare the GDP to energy consumption rates. So GDP is dollars per time. Energy consumption is energy per time. So really, it's a comparison of energy to money, to currency. And what I'm doing is saying that it's energy consumption rates. It's a flow of energy that gives inherently the value. And from what I can tell, that's not something, an approach that's been done before.
So I'm going to draw this to a close, but first I want to ask my own question here. And you've chosen to use global data for your analysis, Tim, but if you break it out on a country-by-country basis, and if you were to pick Sweden, for example, as an example, lambda has not been constant in Sweden over the last several decades, in the sense that their GDP has grown by 40% or so, while their actual gross energy consumption has fallen. And so is that then setting an example for the rest of us that, in fact, you can break this kind of vicious cycle that you've painted?
Well, first off, I'm not comparing GDP to energy consumption. It's the accumulated GDP over the entirety of history to energy consumption. So that, as a globe, that relationship of GDP to energy consumption is actually, what's it going down to, going up? Yeah, we get more GDP per energy consumption. That's true as a globe. That's definitely not a constant. Lambda relates the wealth, which has units of currency, not currency per time, to rates of energy consumption. And I would love to be able to calculate that for individual countries. It's not totally obvious how to do that because, I mean, there aren't statistics for Sweden's economy in 1 AD. And I'm not actually sure it's relevant. I think when you think about the economies, well, they're interconnected through trade. You can't really separate Sweden. It's not a closed system. So when you think about things thermodynamically, you want to draw your boundary around something and then be able to express the flows across that boundary in a way that's physically sensible. And it's not really obvious how to do that for Sweden. Perhaps you could do it, but it's much easier to treat the entire system as a globe. And even then, you can think practically about, well, what is Sweden doing in order to make a system more efficient? Maybe making a system more efficient, where it's consuming less energy for its GDP, is simply a representation of it outsourcing its production to China, which is probably true of all developed countries, where what they have essentially done is, as a country, it goes down. But that's not really representative, because the whole system is fundamentally interconnected through international trade. A dollar here is tied to a dollar anywhere else in the world.
Thanks very much. Well, we've been, I think, privileged to hear a provocative, stimulating, insightful overview this morning of the relationship, the disquieting relationship, perhaps, to the way in which we conduct our lifestyles and the energy consumption that we attach to it. One could walk away from here thinking, I'm depressed, I'm going to eat, drink, and be merry, and that's the end of it, I'll just enjoy it until the world collapses.
But I do think instead what this really is a call to arms for all of us. It reinforces the point that Winston Churchill made so forcefully, I think, in 1936, when he used the phrase, the fierce urgency of now, in reference to the threat coming from Europe at that time with respect to world peace. And we face, I think, the same kind of challenge as an energy-utilizing society in addressing the question of how are we going to decarbonize? And what Tim has done this morning, I think, is to illuminate the enormity of the challenge in front of us. It's not going to be easy. But I don't think anyone should leave this room feeling depressed. I do think that there are ways which we can decarbonize, and we need to start acting on them much more actively than we have been. So please join me in thanking Tim for a most stimulating presentation.